This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Some of us were able to use the solitary days of the pandemic to catch up on the reading. For writer and critic Douglas Wolk, that meant wrapping up a modest project to finish consuming some 27,000 comic books. The entirety of Marvel Comics' output, spanning more than half a century.
I read sitting at my desk, I read on treadmills, I read when I was on public transportation. Pretty much however I could get away with reading, I read.
I know. It's nuts. As if that weren't enough, this native of East Lansing and Eisner Award winner has proceeded to write a book about the experience. It is aptly titled All of the Marvels, and it published October 12th. Douglas, first of all, congratulations on getting to the end of this. I hope your eyeballs have not fallen out of your head yet.
I'm recuperating, let's put it that way.
I mean, as a scholar and critic of the form, you had read an awful lot of Marvel already. What made you want to go all in?
I really wanted to see what the half-million-page Marvel story would look like if you thought of it as a story, as a single story, a single narrative that's been going on for 60 years, what its overall shape would be and what it said about the world that made it and the world that read it and the world that was happening outside it as it's been being published every week for more than half a century.
May I also ask, dear God, how?
It's a lot. I read 7 or 8 hours a day for a year and a half or so. I read sitting at my desk. I read on treadmills. I read when I was on public transportation. I read when I had my phone with me and could spare a few minutes. I read a lot of stuff on the Marvel Unlimited app. I read a lot of stuff from physical comics. I pretty much, however I could get away with reading, I read.
It sounds either blissful or terrifying. Maybe it was a bit of both.
It was kind of both. I think a certain amount of Stockholm syndrome set in at some point. Like, I started being able to enjoy anything, like, no matter how questionable or iffy a particular comic was, I could find something to kind of grab onto and enjoy in it.
We should say you did give yourself some parameters. The titles you were reading were published between, I believe, 1961 and 2017, right?
Well, I said 2017 just so I'd have a stop date. I didn't really stop, but
yeah.
I didn't feel obligated to read everything after 2017.
Right. You state very early on in the book that it would be extremely unwise for any sane human being to read the entire Marvel output in sequence. Why is that?
That was not how it was ever meant to be read. I didn't even read it in sequence myself. I grazed. I kind of jumped around. I had a spreadsheet with everything, but whatever I felt like reading on any given day, that's what I read. It was not meant to be read all the way through from the beginning. It was always meant to be, follow your taste, pick up what you like, ignore what you don't like. It's all one big story and it's all connected, but you don't have to read all of it. You really don't.
Yeah. The structure of the book is a sort of a tour guide, and with you as our tour guide, I should say, just sort of calling out a few things that are of interest as you look at not just specific characters, but specific story arcs and crossovers. And it is a global look at Marvel's output in that way. And there's just so much stuff sparkling off the pages. I should say that my credit card bill has done some depressing things since I read this, because now I've been ordering a bunch of stuff that I didn't think I was interested in, and now you made me want to read it. But the structure of it this way, to sort of go at it in terms of some picks and some points of interest, is really interesting. And we can feel your enthusiasm coming out of it.
Thank you. Yeah, I like the idea of being a guide to this enormous, weird territory. As somebody who has covered basically every inch of it, you don't necessarily want to see everything. You don't even necessarily just want to see the high points. You probably want to get a sense of the lay of the land, what it all looks like, so you can find the parts of it that interest you. That's what I'm interested in being. I'm interested in being that kind of guide, not you must read these things in this order, but here's some stuff that might interest you.
Will you read for us from the book?
Sure. I'm making it sound like immersion in the stuff is all fun, which it's not. Caring about superhero comics will empty your pockets, break your heart, and fill you with red-eyed indignation. They linger over stupidity and violence and prey on their audience's emotional identification and sense of incomplete understanding. There is cruelty and unfairness to creative geniuses stamped into every page. The whole structure is balanced on a disintegrating pile of flimsy, trivial amusements created for children of the baby boom. What makes it worthwhile, for me, and for at least some other people who follow serial superhero comics, is that there is a particular, deep kind of joy that comes from that practice. Read half a dozen of Marvel's better comics, and you might get the buzz of a good adventure story, see some striking artwork, and be introduced to a few memorable characters. Read 100, and you start to get a sense of what their devotees find special, that they add up to a collaborative story built for delight, whose various tellers' specific visions are its most important aspect. Read 1,000, and every little detail of them becomes charged with meaning, as another world, which is also a stranger, more vivid version of our own world, is slowly revealed to you. A world of constant spectacle and drama, so broad and complicated that its mysteries perpetually unfold over hundreds of pages every week.
Douglas, it seems almost unfair, given the number of creators, writers, artists, and others who have had their hands on these storylines across these 27,000 issues, to ask about themes. But did you find, in tackling the canon this way, were there questions that these comics can answer for us beyond just emptying our pockets and breaking our hearts?
And entertaining us. Don't forget about the entertainment
part. Of course.
They're real entertaining when they're good. There are some themes that pop out. There are lots of ways in which these stories echo the world in which they were produced. Comic books are always very much of their moment. You know, if you look at 60 years worth of Iron Man stories, that is 60 years worth of stories about how do we feel about the military-industrial complex. That's literally who Tony Stark is. Tony Stark, Iron Man, is an arms manufacturer who becomes a superhero through making weaponry. And the way that we feel about that in 1963, 64, when the Cold War is going full strength, is really different from how we feel about it in 1972, when Vietnam is looking really ugly, and you start to see in the comics, you know, protesters show up at the Stark International plant and they're protesting. That's really different from how we feel in the late 1980s, when relations between the US and the Eastern Bloc are feeling very different, and you're starting to see much more kind of worry about what the US government is doing from inside the states. That's different from what you see in the 2000s, when conflict can be military, but it also has a lot to do with information and surveillance. And so that strain starts showing up in Iron Man stories. It keeps changing. It's always something about the world that is around it, the world that produced it. And that's fascinating.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Spider-Man. Need I say more? Stick around.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
I came away from the book feeling like the storyline that must have been the hardest to work on over the years must have been Spider-Man, because Peter Parker's tale of getting his powers and coming to terms with his responsibilities for his powers repeated itself so many times over the years. Almost the smallest kid knows the story that Peter Parker was bitten by this spider and suddenly he becomes Spider-Man. At the same time, he's just a teenager dealing with grief. And yet, this is one of Marvel's most popular characters, too. Did you find, in your reads, did you find the way the story repeated itself redundant or more like Baroque variations on a theme?
It was really interesting to see how the Spider-Man worked out. In there are a number of variations of the Spider-Man story that we've seen over time. Whenever we go to some new iteration of the Spider-Man story, though, the Ultimate Spider-Man comics or the movie series that we've seen over the last few years, it's always Peter Parker in high school. Because Spider-Man is really very much a coming-of-age story. And you're right, there are cycles. It does repeat. It's the itsy-bitsy spider. You know, he gets to a certain point in his life, and then everything collapses for him, and he has to start all over again. That's interesting to see. Sometimes it gets frustrating to see, you know, how long can this story, this coming-of-age story, go on? How many times can Peter Parker build himself up to the point where he has reconciled himself with his world and then have it fall apart and have to start over? And that's a problem with a story that can never end, can never reboot, can never start again. But it's also kind of beautiful because it's a creative constriction. It's something that writers and artists have to work with, and sometimes they come up with extraordinary things.
Yeah. Well, and I think the book is a great reminder of how fundamental some of these characters have become and how fundamental their myths have become. You're touring us through some notable Spider-Man stories, and you talk about Amazing Fantasy number 15. Mm-hmm. But can you explain what happens in the last few panels of that first issue? Because it feels like it still has power today, and it still feels bold today.
It really does. Like that first Spider-Man story in Amazing Fantasy number 15, it's 11 pages long, 11 pages, and it does so much. I was talking with somebody for my podcast a couple of weeks ago who said that he had been in a car with a couple of his nieces and nephews, and they were talking about Spider-Man, and one of them said, "Hey, how did Spider-Man get started?" And, you know, this is a young kid, had never heard the story before, and so my friend I was talking to told the story of the lonely teenager and the spider bite and the strange powers and the aunt and uncle who raised him and the kid who suddenly jumps into showbiz with his new abilities and the arrogant mistake that he makes and the uncle's death and the realization that he could have stopped the killer but didn't. And in the last few panels of the story, Peter Parker is walking away, sobbing at his own failure. That's a really unusual way for a superhero origin to end, for a first story to end. And so my friend was telling this story to the kids in the car, and they were flabbergasted. Their jaws were dropped. It's a great story. Never heard it before. It's a great story. And it has become part of Spider-Man's DNA. It has become part of our cultural DNA. Everybody knows that story. Everybody has gotten the sense of that story, whether they've read that particular comic, which has been reprinted a billion times, or not. The MCU movies with Spider-Man don't go into his origin. They don't go into the spider bite. They don't even mention his Uncle Ben, because everybody knows that story already. They don't have to.
You also spend some time with characters that will be less familiar to folks outside of comic book diehard circles. The one I wanted to ask you about is someone who's arguably a little bit more famous now, and that's Marvel's newest on-screen theatrical hero, Shang-Chi.
Yeah.
He was the protagonist of this 10-year series called Master of Kung Fu. And there are good reasons why a lot of people have never heard of it. The original comics were a hot mess of appropriation and Asian stereotypes, even in an industry where white creators were known for rampantly lifting stories. And yet, you write about the fact that it does some things with action scenes and artwork and with contemplation of violence that hadn't been done before. Reading the whole of the series, what kind of taste did it leave in your mouth overall?
Master of Kung Fu is a strange case. It, you know, as you say, it's where Shang-Chi originally appeared. It starred him from 1973 or so to about 1983. It's extraordinary. It's brilliant. It's beautiful. It's super, super problematic. And it's worth wrestling with. There is stuff that you can cringe at just about all over the place. And there's also stuff that is absolutely spectacularly gorgeous and thoughtful and kind of profound. And those things are together in the same comic. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about it is that in its letter columns, people were writing in and saying, this is a really interesting comic, and there's stuff in here that is just really a problem, and please think about this. Think about the fact that literally Fu Manchu is a major character in the story. Think about the way that you are coloring Asian characters differently from other characters, and sometimes with like bright yellow tones. This is a big problem. And they were writing into the letter columns, and these letters were being printed in the comic itself, and the creators were responding to them and listening to their arguments and paying attention. And eventually, with some difficulty and over some time, changing and doing better. That's right there. It's played out in the comic itself, on the pages, in the letter columns, and it's amazing to see.
As you came forward through time with Marvel, and again, I understand that you weren't reading sequentially, but when you look back at some of the characters and stories that come up later in Marvel's history, like Southeast Michigan perennial favorite Kamala Khan, or yes, Jessica Jones, or some of the newer characters, is there anything that you found developing that stands in a position of difference from where Marvel started?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when Marvel started, it was really one and a half writers and four and a half artists, like a very, very limited number of creators, basically all white men living in New York within a certain age range who were making these things together. And a lot of their protagonists were guys who were pretty much like them one way or the other. We're starting to see that change. You start to see that change a bit in the 60s, a bit more in the 70s, and much more in the past decade or so. There is a much, much broader range of the sorts of people who get to be the protagonist of these stories and who get to be the creators of these stories. And that's two different issues, but there's much more. There's a much wider range, and I love seeing that. I mean, you know, I'm a 51-year-old cishet white guy. If I never read another comic with a character who's just about exactly like me, that's fine. I'm set for life on that. What I like is reading stuff by people who are, in significant ways, not a lot like me, and about characters who are, in significant ways, not a lot like me. And there's a lot more of that, and I'm so happy to see it.
Critic Douglas Wolk's new book is called All of the Marvels. It published October 12th. You can also find his podcast, The Voice of Latveria, wherever you get your podcasts. That's our podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find full Stateside episodes to listen to at michiganradio.org via stream. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by Aaron Allen and by Laura. Our theme music is by 14KT with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.